17. As Simon drove to Leongatha Hospital, Heather was still puzzling over the crockery on which Erin had served lunch. She mentioned the coloured plate again, he told Nanette. She said, she asked me, is Erin short of crockery? Is that why she would have this different kind of coloured plate that she served herself with? And I said, yes, Erin doesn't have that many plates, and that may be the reason. They reached the hospital at 10:57 a.m. Simon took Ian and Heather inside, and even the short walk into reception had them doubling over. They were immediately assessed by triage nurse Tiny Matthew, while Simon called Ian and Heather's daughter Ruth and her husband Brad Dubois. The urgency in Simon's voice was unmistakable, and they said they would head straight over. Meanwhile, Tiny had taken Ian and Heather straight through to the plaster room, which is like an isolation ward in Leongatha Hospital. From there, Tiny quickly paged her on-call doctor, Chris Webster, who was like the centre-half forward of rural health. While the nursing staff were helping Ian and Heather, and Ruth and Brad were on their way, Simon had a few minutes to take a breath and think through what the hell had happened. It must have been the lunch. Don, Gail, Ian and Heather had all fallen sick at exactly the same time, with precisely the same symptoms, and they had all had lunch together at Erin's the previous day. Whatever the bug was that was knocking them for six, its source was obvious. What the hell had Erin served up? The call charge record for Erin's phone shows that Simon called her at 11:08 a.m. Erin must have guessed what it was about. She and Simon hadn't spoken for a week. He'd been picking their kids up and dropping them off without showing the slightest interest in talking to Erin at all. And now, when he should be in church, he was calling her. Although, I suppose, if Erin was innocent and didn't know what she'd added to her beef wellingtons, maybe it did come as a surprise. So what did Simon tell her? First, he asked Erin if she was at church. No, she wasn't. And then? I told her that Mum and Dad and Heather and Ian were all crook and that they'd all been admitted to hospital, remembered Simon. And Erin's reply, as Simon remembered it, she said she'd been having some diarrhoea herself and it was about quite frequent. It was at this point, according to Simon, that Erin told him her symptoms had begun late on Saturday afternoon and she'd been worried about having an accident when she drove Barnaby home because, by then, she'd been needing the toilet about every 20 minutes. But that wasn't how Erin remembered this conversation. She did agree that Simon had told her that Don and Gail had been admitted to hospital, but she didn't remember him talking about Ian and Heather. That Simon wouldn't mention Ian and Heather, given they were the people he was actually with at the time, didn't seem to make sense to me, but maybe he didn't. The conversation that Erin remembered having was just about Don and Gail. They had talked about what Don and Gail were experiencing and why they were in hospital. Although, strangely, neither Erin nor Simon recalled the lunch meal itself being part of the conversation. I guess it was a given. Particularly if Erin was sick too. Something in the lunch had been off and given them all a tummy bug. And yes, Erin had told Simon that she had also been experiencing diarrhoea, but she didn't believe that she'd said that it had started at 4 or 4:30 p.m. In Erin's recollection, she might have mentioned that her diarrhoea had begun on Saturday evening, and maybe she said it was on her mind when she drove Barnaby home, but all in all, as she was telling it to us in the courtroom, she was walking back the detail and severity of her diarrhoea during the early part of Saturday night quite a way, particularly compared to the details that Simon had remembered her discussing. To me, even though I was trying to presume Erin's tragic accident explanation for her fatal lunch was true for as long as possible, this was all beginning to smell a bit fishy. Taking all these loose threads and different versions and the various course corrections being attempted here and there, it looked to me like Erin had tied herself into something of a knot. If she was guilty Erin, while she had just been told that Don and Gail were in hospital with what appeared to be very severe gastro, she knew the truth. And it was very likely that Simon hadn't mentioned when Don and Gail had first become sick. She didn't yet know they'd been fine up until midnight. But she did want to make it sound like they had all eaten the same thing and she had also picked up the same bug. So she did talk about her diarrhea starting before she drove Barnaby home, and she continued telling slightly different versions of that time frame regarding the onset of her diarrhea to several doctors over the coming days, too many to be able to rewrite the story completely. It was some time before she realised that the early onset of her symptoms would give her a problem, but all she could do now was try to water it down and vague it out as best she could. Because the problem it had given her was a big one, but it only became apparent when the cause of the illness had been identified as deathcap mushroom. How the ammonita toxins in deathcap mushrooms are absorbed into the bloodstream and find their way to the liver, then are kicked back out into the bile before getting reabsorbed into the bloodstream and taken back into the liver, has been well studied. There are very strong biochemical reasons why human beings don't start suffering the consequences of being poisoned by deathcap mushrooms until around 10 to 12 hours after they have consumed them. That delay rarely occurs in bacterial gastrointestinal illnesses. And the reverse, a case where the onset of symptoms from ammonita toxins occurs much quicker than usual, simply can't and hasn't happened. So the problem Erin had, once everyone knew that death caps were involved, was this. She was saying she had eaten the same meal at the same time and was suffering the same consequences from the same poison as all her lunch guests. But the diarrhea from which she was suffering could not have been caused by death cap mushrooms if that diarrhea began only 4 or 5 hours after eating lunch. That was simply not possible. How could she reconcile this situation? Had Erin eaten the same meal as her guests, but then fallen ill from something else entirely, and magically missed having any death caps on her Wellington? Or was guilty Erin unable to escape this dilemma? Had she just been pretending she'd eaten the same meal by faking the same symptoms, only to be found out by a timeline that could not fit the hard medical facts? The only other explanation seemed to be the most unlikely of them all. What if she was innocent and was telling the truth and wasn't faking anything? If that was the case, though, she must have ingested death caps at around 9 o'clock on the morning of the lunch. How could this have possibly happened? It seemed ridiculous and totally unexplainable, until Colin, in his closing address, suggested just that. During Erin's evidence in chief, Colin had, in my view, been very deft in not asking why Erin hadn't retasted her mushroom mixture after she added the foraged mushrooms to it. And we could all see why Colin had wanted to avoid that question, because to ask it would have been inviting the obvious conclusion that Erin must have known that the new mixture would make her sick. But Colin had not wanted to imply that Erin really had done the natural thing and retasted the mixture, because if she had done that, why wasn't she dead? Suddenly, however, in a light bulb moment that led to a backflip with a double somersault, Colin was telling us that is what had happened. Erin had been oblivious to what she was really adding to her mushroom duxelle, and she had retasted it to make sure it now had flavour. But of course she hadn't taken a whole mouthful. No one does that. She'd just taken a pinch, a quarter of a teaspoon at most, an itty-bitty bit, just enough to make her a little bit sick, but not really sick. There you go. That explained everything. It really had all been a tragic accident. That explanation, however, didn't make its appearance until the very end of the trial, and the impossible timeline that it attempted to explain was the reason why we had witnessed such dodging and weaving over what Simon and Aaron had actually said to each other in that first phone call. It was also why there would be ongoing debate about whether Aaron really did have a minor touch of toxic poisoning or not. But let's come back to 11:30 a.m. on Sunday the 30th of July and pretend we don't know anything more than anyone else did at that time. Four people were very sick. Another person was either genuinely a bit sick or pretending to be a bit sick. And the general assumption was that something in Aaron's lunch had triggered a nasty bout of bacterial gastro. If Aaron was innocent, at this point she genuinely didn't know what had caused everyone to get sick. If she was guilty, she must have been pretty sure that it'd be a long time before anyone found out, if they ever did. She had a dim view of the medical profession. It had taken them 8 months to identify Bronte's problem after she was born, even with Aaron screaming at them, and they had x-rayed the wrong side of Jack's body before his knee surgery. She had possibly got away with three previous attempts to poison Simon without anyone being able to work out what had really happened. Not that I was meant to remember anything about those charges, of course. Silly me. I've just forgotten about them again. Honest. Anyway, if Aaron was guilty, I'm sure she was pretty certain she had these nongs outsmarted. That's where we were. With Dr. Chris Webster, who had finished his rounds and come straight through to see Ian and Heather. He had been in contact with Corranborough Hospital, where Don had told nurse Lisa Shannon that it must have been Saturday's lunch of beef Wellington, beans and mash that had caused all these problems. Chris checked this theory with Ian and Heather. Yes, they were also sure it was Saturday's lunch. It had to be. In Chris's thinking at that point, it was probably the meat. Ian and Heather looked tired and they were still regularly vomiting and suffering diarrhea. But most of the immediate tests that were carried out were returning results within normal limits. Heart rate, blood pressure, kidney and liver function. No issues. They'd obviously lost a lot of fluid, however, and were as weak as kittens, so they were admitted to the general ward with saline IV and medication to help with nausea. Ruth and Brad arrived while Ian and Heather were being settled in the general ward. Ruth's strongest memory was her parents' concern for Aaron. How was Aaron? Had anyone heard or checked in on her? Aaron was playing Monopoly, putting a house on Park Lane, probably, and taking a call from Jack's flying instructor, Ulysses Villalobos. He was running late. Apologies. Could he push Jack's lesson back an hour or two? Aaron was fine with that. She was just determined Jack wouldn't miss it. That was the main thing. As soon as Ruth and Brad arrived at Leongatha Hospital, Simon raced back to Corranborough Hospital to check on his mum and dad. It was the first time he'd actually seen them since the lunch. Don looked terrible. He was on his side, hunched and in considerable pain. Lisa Shannon, the nurse Simon had briefly seen when he first arrived at Corranborough with Ian and Heather, had barely left Don and Gail's side. Speaking was an effort for Dad, Simon recalled, and taking the energy to speak was an effort, and his voice was strained in a way that was, he wasn't right inside. What Don wanted to tell Simon was that Erin had talked to them at lunch about her serious medical issues. Both he and Gail were unsure if it was appropriate for Simon to hear the news from them, but Simon wanted to know. So Don told him that Erin had said she'd had some tests and that she'd had a positive cancer diagnosis. They'd found cancer. Don thought it was ovarian cancer, and she was expecting to have chemo and potentially surgery. Gail added that Erin had also talked about the question of how to break it to the children. They had all believed that Erin and Simon should talk about it with the kids together. As Don and Gail were being moved to the general ward, Simon phoned his siblings, Matthew, Anna, and Nathan, just to bring them up to speed. Neither Don nor Gail was looking great, but it just seemed to be a bad case of gastro. Well worth a visit and some sympathy, but nothing to get too worried about. Something in Erin's lunch must have been off. In the general ward, Simon and his parents were joined by Dr. Slesha Amatia, who was running tests on Don and Gail that were very similar to the ones Dr. Chris Webster was running on Ian and Heather over at Leongatha. As with Ian and Heather, the severity of Don and Gail's vomiting and diarrhoea was not being explained by any other alarming indicators. Their vital signs were within normal parameters and stable. Their electrolytes were normal. There was no blood in their vomit or their stools. Dr. Slesha even ordered that each of them have an electrocardiogram, but that too was normal. Nonetheless, they were admitted to the general ward to be hydrated and monitored because, counter to expectations, their condition simply wasn't improving. While Don, Gail, Ian and Heather were all being closely watched in hospital beds with saline IV drips in all of them, Erin was finally driving Jack to his postponed flying lesson. She did say to us that she had taken some Imodium before the trip. She had considered that a must because the airport at Tyap was a 1 hour and 30 minute drive away and she was still suffering from occasional diarrhoea. Was not, said the prosecution. Was too, said Erin. And to prove it, she told us what had happened during the trip. Bronte was in the back seat with headphones on, watching something on her tablet. Jack was in the front seat, also listening to something on either his phone or his tablet. Erin, meanwhile, had chosen to wear white pants on a day when she was suffering from diarrhoea. Okay, maybe. About half an hour in, she suddenly needed to go, so she pulled the car over somewhere near the Nyora turnoff, hurried into the bush with a box of tissues, and suffered through another attack of the runs. She used the tissues to clean herself and then wrapped them up in a dog poo bag, which she then put in her handbag. Her handbag? When she had a whole boot? What? I swear she said that with a dead straight face, like it was the most normal thing in the whole story. Some minutes later, she stopped at the BP service station at Caldermead, where crystal clear CCTV footage, now easy to find on the internet, shows her parking, walking in with her black handbag over her shoulder, heading into the ladies' restroom for 9 seconds, and then coming out and buying a few snacks for the kids. The entire vision is totally consistent with Erin's story. It really is. It's just that in that footage, she simply doesn't look like someone who's unwell. But can we be sure? Beyond reasonable doubt. If you're recovering from diarrhea, how do you walk around? Don't you at least try to look as normal as possible for as long as you can? 5 minutes before they reached the airport, Ulysses called again. This time he was cancelling the whole lesson. The weather was closing in and it was too dangerous. Erin was annoyed. I'm on her team there. I think we all would be. But what could she do? She turned around and drove home. On the way back, they stopped at the Cooey Rup donut van and bought some more snacks. When Jack was interviewed months later, he remembered the drive and the lesson cancellation, and he remembered buying things at the Cooey Rup van. He didn't remember Erin's bush toilet break, but nor did he remember the stop at the BP service station, which we know happened. Bronte didn't even remember that she'd been on the trip to Tyab. Didn't remember a thing. So I think we can just quietly leave the kids aside. Let's keep them out of this. At Corrinburra Hospital, the staff were much more alert. Lisa Shannon had stayed with Don and Gail the whole time. Don's condition in particular was becoming alarming. His blood pressure was going down. His pulse was up. He could not tolerate any fluids and he was continually vomiting. This was unusual for a standard gastro case. It was becoming a real puzzle. Lisa contacted Dr. Slesha Amatia again, who asked for another blood test and also asked them to try IV ondansetron and oral loperamide, which were two drugs aimed at trying to slow down the vomiting and the diarrhea. Nothing worked. What was going on? They performed a point-of-care I-STAT blood test. This is a rapid, portable diagnostic test performed at the bedside, and it provides immediate results, which in this case gave the medical team their first clue. It showed that Don had a very elevated lactate level. A high lactate level is a strong indicator of some form of metabolic disorder and often points to liver failure. This was far from a normal bout of gastro, and whatever it was much more serious. It was now very clear that the situation was beyond the resources of Little Corranborough Hospital. Dr. Slesha Amatia did not waste time. She organised a transfer to Dandenong Hospital within an hour. Dandenong was a much bigger hospital and was capable of performing a far greater array of tests with far quicker results. As soon as Don and Gail arrived at Dandenong, Dr. Beth Morgan began those tests. She had both of their histories and the information about the lunch they'd eaten. Don's tests in particular revealed severe dehydration and significant kidney damage. Several different liver function tests showed evidence of significant damage. Fluid resuscitation procedures continued without any improvement in Don's condition, and his lactate score remained very, very high. Some form of organ failure was looking imminent, and none of this seemed to be consistent with gastroenteritis, even severe gastroenteritis. Dr. Morgan referred these results to Dandenong Hospital's toxicology unit, and later that evening, she called the toxicology registrar, Dr. Mark Douglas. He asked what the patients had all eaten at this lunch. A beef Wellington, Dr. Morgan told him. Their presentation had been severe, but the onset of symptoms had been quite delayed. Dr. Morgan wanted to know whether Don's clinical state could be explained by toxic mushrooms. Dr. Douglas knew in seconds. He knew that pattern. Yes, it certainly could be. He called his lead toxicologist, who agreed it was a possibility, but they needed more evidence. As the evening progressed and Don and Gail's health deteriorated further, the evidence mounted. Final, incontrovertible clinical proof would take almost another week, but from the moment Beth Morgan had called Mark Douglas, one explanation for the severity of this mass gastro attack that previously had not even been considered became the most likely. They'd been poisoned with death cap mushrooms. If Erin Patterson was guilty and had thought there was a good chance the medical profession would never be able to figure this out, she had miscalculated. They'd done it in less than a day.